It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it. Welcome to day 735 of Roman Reigns as the Universal Champion. I heard Drew McIntyre was out at the pub into the wee hours, singing show tunes with his new best friend Tyson Fury. One down, two to go. We've got NXT Worlds Collide and AEW All Out coming up in a few hours. 735 may be the magic number for Roman Reigns, but 772 is the magic number for the Solo Monster Sounds Off. This is episode 772 for Sunday, September 4th. 2022, it is Labor Day weekend. I'm definitely putting in the labor this weekend. Thank you to everybody who has been joining the live streams. Even Friday night, we had a big night. Picked up a lot of new channel members. I cannot thank you all enough. Today, we're going to talk about Clash at the Castle, the fallout from yesterday's pay-per-view, AEW All Out predictions for the pay-per-view tonight, Triple H's sit-down with Ariel Helwani and the comments that he made that pissed off Chris Jericho, the former Universal Champion who is returning on Raw tomorrow night, the AEW star said to have asked for his release and was turned down, an update on the fall of the Velveteen Dream, what a mess, and I've got thoughts on the Rey Mysterio A&E biography, which was very good. So a lot to get into here. Don't forget that you can pick up a copy, an audiobook copy of the Brian Gewirtz book. Former WWE head writer Brian Gewirtz spent 15 years working for that company, so I'm sure he knows where some of those bodies are buried, called There's Just One Problem. And you can download the audiobook version. If you are an Amazon Prime member, you can get 2 free audiobooks when you use our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. So pick up the Brian Gewirtz book and maybe pick up the Jon Moxley audiobook as well. That one Mox narrates himself. And so go ahead and check that out and take advantage of that. I want to say thank you to all of our PayPal producers. You could always make a PayPal donation, thesolomonster.com. You'll see the link right there at the top of the link tree. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. I want to say thank you to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills, Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, Big B, Brian Becerra, Killshot, Keith Hart, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Caleb Showtime Lindley, Shin Superkick Akuma, Dashing David Brown, who is in Chicago this weekend with his friend Martin, all the way from Glasgow, Scotland, to enjoy AEW All Out tonight. David, I hope you have a blast. Jimmy Lee, crack corn, but he don't care because he got Olympic gold. Ifrene. Boy, that's a long name. Jimmy, he's been a listener of the Sound Off since 2009 when I pitched the idea of Christian joining Edge and Vicky Guerrero's La Familia group, which would have then led to Edge betraying Christian in a singles match between the two at WrestleMania 25. I don't even remember that, but I'm glad he does. And he celebrated his birthday last Sunday by going to the House of Glory show. So happy belated birthday to Jimmy Lee. Also, shout out to Dean the Mighty Mo Mowbray. Check out his Scenescape Shop Etsy store, as well as his YouTube channel at Scenescape Shop, all one word, to see all of his artwork and prints, not only of pro wrestlers, but other celebrities as well. Right now, he's painting Hulk Hogan, the Macho Man, and Hacksaw Jim Duggan. And when you visit Etsy.com/shop/scenescape shop, you can use the discount code SOLOMONSTER. Exclusively for listeners of The Sound Off, you get 20% off at checkout. He's got a cool one up there right now of Rocky Balboa shouting out Drago. You can hang it in your gym at home and give you that little bit of extra motivation. And finally here, I got this email from Alberto that put a smile on my face, so I want to shout him out here. He said, I want to say thanks for all that you do. I'm grateful for TV Tracks showing me your channel. It has really helped me in the last few years when I really haven't been doing well mentally. Balancing life, social work, military, and other things, your show and the extras really helped get me through it all. I also want to thank you for BetterHelp. I got connected to a therapist quickly and have taken the first step in taking care of my mental health, something I never really did before. Thank you for telling us about the service and for your show. And Alberto, thank you for sharing that. I get emails like that from time to time. I've actually gotten a whole bunch of emails from people talking about BetterHelp, and they didn't know about it until I, you know, promoted it and talked about it on the podcast. So I love hearing stuff like that, especially when it's stuff that I'm yeah, obviously they're a sponsor of the show, but I bring them in for a reason. And it is a service that has been helpful to a lot of people. So I'm very happy to hear that it was helpful to him, and I hope you're doing well. So let's talk about Clash at the Castle here. We'll just give the top line overview of exactly what went down yesterday, and I got some more thoughts here. Obviously, the big story coming out of the show is the fact that Roman Reigns is still the undisputed WWE Universal Champion. This was the big UK stadium show from Cardiff 30 years after SummerSlam 1992. They were back in the UK for a major stadium show, over 62,000 people. I thought overall it was an excellent show. I had a lot of fun watching it. A lot of people didn't have fun with the ending of that show, which was Roman Reigns winning yet again. And Drew McIntyre losing to Roman Reigns after all of this build-up and all of just the videos showing him from the time that he got into the business to his first run, to his firing, to his whole redemption story arc. It all built to this moment in Cardiff. He got Broken Dreams back as part of his entrance. Everything seemed to be building to the big moment for Drew McIntyre, but it was not to be. The bloodline has expanded. There were a lot of rumors the last few weeks that Solo Sikoa, the third Uso, was going to get called up from NXT. And that's exactly what happened. He interfered at the end of the match. It looked like Drew had the match won. Solo Sikoa pulls the referee out of the ring, pulls down the hoodie to reveal himself, turns around, gets speared, and Roman Reigns retains his championship and lives to fight on. 735 days now and beyond. And I said this last night, you know, Lex Luger at the end of his main event at SummerSlam in 93 celebrated his failed title win with balloons, and everybody came out and hoisted him up on their shoulders, and balloons are falling from the ceiling. Drew McIntyre celebrated his loss by singing American Pie with Tyson Fury. In the end, though, the end result is still the same. They're both still losers. Now, at least Lex won his match, although I did say that the Lex thing is worse, because Lex Luger actually encouraged the referee to count Yokozuna out of the ring, knowing full well the title could not change hands on a countout. So as a young fan, you watch that and you say, boy, this guy is dumb. $1 million body, 10-cent brain. I still think that's worse. But, you know, look, if you're ever going to put the championship or championships on Drew McIntyre, you're never going to have a better moment for it than last night. And what that tells me is that they don't have any plans in the foreseeable future, anytime in the near term or the midterm, of putting the championship on Drew. And if they do, then it's completely ridiculous that they wouldn't have taken advantage of the circumstances and did it and given this you know, everybody this big moment. I mean, yes, it was very UK-centric, and maybe there are people here in this country who aren't sold on McIntyre, who don't give a shit like the people in the stadium would have given a shit. But WWE's all about moments. They always talk about moments, right? We're about moments, WrestleMania moments. And I'm just saying, if the plan is at some point to get the title on McIntyre, I mean, look, this is I bring it back to Luger. Why did they book Luger the way they did at SummerSlam in 93? What was Vince McMahon thinking? What was going through his head when he put that guy in a bus for 5 or 6 weeks and built him up the way that he did just to have him win but lose in the way that he did? Because he wanted to put it off until WrestleMania and give him a bigger moment in Madison Square Garden. Well, by the time they got there, the moment had passed and people didn't want to see that. They wanted to see somebody else. And he never did get that moment. it could be a situation here where maybe the thinking is, you know what, we'll save it for maybe not WrestleMania next year, but we'll save it for another time. There is no other time that will ever match the moment that they had in that stadium yesterday. So that pretty much, I mean, again, Drew is not buried. They have to rely on him because he's still one of the biggest baby faces they have in the entire company. But it was a squandered opportunity if you are a Drew McIntyre fan. There's no doubt about it. And here's my other issue with this. I don't hate on it because I do think Cody Rhodes is the better story. And I would like to see Cody Rhodes end up being the one to take that championship. But what they did at the end of this match when it was over was just bizarre. Now, I can understand them doing something like this in front of the live crowd, send him home happy. But they kept the cameras rolling and they kept this on television and they had Tyson Fury get in the ring for what I was thinking. Maybe this is an angle. Maybe he's going to attack Drew. Maybe Drew is going to snap and attack him. These guys have been talking shit to each other on social media and in interviews now for years. And they ended up, you know, shaking hands and hugging like fast friends. And then you've got Tyson Fury on the microphone singing karaoke. Now, I understand that he sings after some of his fights. But how many songs do you remember Tyson Fury singing? How many times did he break out into song after losing a fight? None. Because he never loses. So it was goofy to see Drew McIntyre lose and get fucked over by the Bloodline and then start singing and talking about, we're going to go out and party. After they went and let the air out of the crowd like popping a balloon. Yeah, I saw that Ariel Helwani, and I like Ariel, and I get that he has access now to all of this talent for interviews. He did that long sit-down with Triple H, and he was interviewing talent all weekend in Cardiff, right? He's doing it for BT Sport. He's got access. He's got that press pass. I get it. I get how it is. He's got to do what he's got to do. But I saw where he said after the show was over that Drew McIntyre's stock, in his view, actually went up as a result of the match yesterday. He said this with a straight face. You know, he also said that Drew, it was a big moment for him to be in the main event of the show. And all of that is true. Yes, it was a very big moment for him to be in the main event of the show. And he is still going to be one of the big names on the WWE roster. But the idea that, oh, I think his stock actually went up as a result of the finish of this match. If his stock went up, I hate to see what happens to it when the markets open on Monday morning. But Roman Reigns lives on. And as far as where they go with him in the short term, because Cody Rhodes ain't going to be back for a while, they're still hoping that Cody will be back in time for the Royal Rumble. There's no guarantee of that. I mean, a pec tear is a serious injury. His pec tear was very serious. And he even said, like, during surgery and everything, he almost hemorrhaged. That's how much you saw all that blood under the skin. I mean, it was a very serious injury. So there's no guarantee that he'll even be back in time to first build to a WrestleMania match. That's what they're hoping. That's what he's hoping for. But you never know with these things. Well, what do you do for now with Roman Reigns? Do you go for a rematch with McIntyre at Extreme Rules? You could. You could do another match. It's not like he's going to win. And if he did, how ridiculous would that be? To do it there and not do it yesterday. So I don't know if they're going to go right back to a Drew McIntyre match. I don't know if they're going to, you know, move on to a totally new challenger that we're not thinking of. I don't know if they're going to finally, you know, break Sami Zayn away from the Bloodline now that Solo Sikoa has joined. And then Sami, they'll turn Sami and do Sami and Roman. I mean, there's so many different things they could do, potentially. I have no idea where they're going to go next with Roman Reigns. But now that they did what they did, as I look ahead, when is the next big WWE show? Well, the next big show, not counting, you know, whatever the Saudi Arabia show is in November, is going to be Survivor Series at the end of November. And it's very likely that there will not be a championship match at Survivor Series if the past is any indication. Usually it's champion against champion, brand versus brand, but the title isn't on the line. Even if they did like a, I mean, it might be wishful thinking, but like a War Games or something like that, brand versus brand, it doesn't look like the titles are going to be defended. Although I would think if they are going to do one-on-one Raw versus SmackDown champion against champion, they would want to split the title somehow between now and then. I don't see him losing. I don't see him having a major championship match. So then you look beyond Survivor Series, and all of a sudden, you're into the Royal Rumble. It's already WrestleMania season. So at this point, you may as well just wait until WrestleMania and have Roman drop the championship at WrestleMania. But that opens up a whole other question. What about The Rock? They're trying to get The Rock. They're hoping to get The Rock. Triple H said as much when he sat down with Ariel. It's up to Rock, he said. It's his call. Well, if you get The Rock, then you don't need the championship on the line. So that, now the question is, what is the best time for Roman Reigns to actually drop these fucking things? I don't know. There's more questions than answers. But now that Drew has been lugered, Cody Rhodes is the only answer. The Cody Rhodes story with him finally winning that WWE title, the title that his father had taken away from him. Right? He told the story when he was on Monday Night Raw after he came back. That's the story to tell. That's the story to tell. And the performance that he had at Hell in a Cell in June, all that did was, I mean, that just solidified the legend of Cody Rhodes in this company. There really is no other person now who makes sense, even remotely, I think, to put the title on than Cody Rhodes. But we have a long time before we get there. I think a lot of people have Roman Reigns fatigue. It's the reason why I've called it the Reigns of Terror. I mean, that's where we are now. WrestleMania is still a long time away. Austin Theory attempted a Money in the Bank cash-in again. He got foiled. He got punched in the face and knocked out by Tyson Fury when he tried to cash in. Karrion Kross was in the front row. You know what? He probably is going to be the next challenger for Drew McIntyre. So that probably is the next feud for Drew coming out of this show. I don't think that the main event finish ruined the show. I still like the show. I still thought it was an excellent show. But yes, it was a very deflating finish. It really took the wind out of a lot of people's sails at the end of the show. And I do think some of the hate that the show got is due exclusively to what they did at the end. But it was also a show that was built entirely around the main event. So you have to imagine that if people are unhappy with the finish, it's going to affect their viewpoint of the show. For me, I still thought it was an excellent show. Matt Riddle and Seth Rollins, they went in there. They had a very good match. You know, Rollins also did an interview with Ariel Helwani, and he was very clear that he does not like Matt Riddle. This was not a work. This was not a put-on. This was not just part of the storyline. He went into the whole thing about his, you know, Riddle's ex-wife making that comment on Instagram where she, you know, he said she was body-shaming some of the women's wrestlers. I remember that. What she did was, it wasn't a direct attack on Becky Lynch, who obviously is married to Seth, and so he's going to take offense to that. What it was is, she really was. She was talking about how these women on the roster, because there are still some people who have no idea what happened with Riddle's wife. What happened is, she put a post up totally randomly on her Instagram, and she included a picture of Becky Lynch, but it was a picture of Becky in the ring, and it was a picture of her ass, basically. And what she was saying is, you have all these women on the roster with big asses, and they have, you know, they really need to tone up and basically lose weight. And but she used a picture of Becky and her posterior in doing so. But she was really talking about the entire women's roster in WWE. Because Riddle's ex-wife, I think, is like a fitness, I don't know if she's a bodybuilder, but I know she's big into fitness. And so obviously people did not take that very kindly, not the least of which was Seth Rollins, because she used a picture of his wife. Although then girlfriend, now wife. And that was the source of the heat between him and Riddle. And he even admitted in the interview with Ariel a lot of the stuff that was said on the internet at the time that he did not want to work with him when he got called up from NXT, because I think Riddle was still in NXT when that happened. When he got called up, he made it very clear, I don't want to work with the guy. I don't want to be around him. I don't want to work with him. Now, since then, you know, they've made up. They're able to work together and be professional. But he said, I don't like this guy. Just the way he conducts himself. He'll go out there and talk shit about people who are bigger names than him, like Brock Lesnar and Bill Goldberg. And I don't like him. I don't like hanging out with him. But he admitted that, you know, the two of us have tremendous chemistry in the ring together. We go in there and we work very well together. And I wonder if a lot of that has to do with that dislike. I wonder if some of that at least is born out of that dislike that Rollins has for him. I don't know if Riddle hates Rollins the way that Rollins dislikes Riddle, but they do work well together, and they had a very good match. Rollins went over. I think we're going to get the rematch at Extreme Rules with an Extreme Rules stipulation, which fits the feud. So that's going to go on. We had Walter and we had Sheamus. This was the match I was looking forward to the most, not only yesterday, but the entire weekend. That includes all of the matches at Worlds Collide, all of the matches at All Out. This was the match I was looking forward to the most. The first Intercontinental title defense on a pay-per-view in nearly a year and a half since last year's WrestleMania. Triple H is making great efforts to try to make the Intercontinental title, to make the United States Championship meaningful again, putting it in a position to be featured on television, putting the IC title back on pay-per-view. These are positive steps. That a month ago, this would not be happening. Because Walter won the championship a while back, and it wasn't like he was still, you know, defending it on pay-per-views and stuff. Nothing, I didn't get the sense anything was really going to change, even under Vince McMahon, even though Walter was getting a push. But it's nice to see. And Sheamus, of course, you had this great story going into the match. Sheamus, for years, has talked about, it's the one title that has eluded me. I need to win that championship to complete my collection. I need to win it because when I was growing up as a wrestling fan, that was the title that was held by people like Mr. Perfect and like Bret Hart and like Shawn Michaels and Ricky Steamboat and all those people. So it means something to him. That's when he grew up as a wrestling fan. And he went in there and he was the babyface. And they beat the holy hell out of each other. But even before the match started, there was good news all around. Because Walter came out not only with Ludwig Kaiser, but he came out with Giovanni Vinci. The former Fabian Aichner used to be part of Imperium. When they called up Walter, they split up Imperium for no real reason. Triple H writing that wrong. Reuniting Imperium. Giovanni Vinci called up to the main roster. We have the trio back together. And that's a solid addition now to the tag team division. It also puts the Bloodline and Imperium on the same roster for the time being. But it's a solid addition to the tag team division. These guys went in there, they had an excellent match. They had a 5-star match in every way. It was exactly what you would have expected it to be. It was a war. It was a question of who's going to be able to outlast the other. And in the end, the answer was Walter. And he finished off Sheamus, he retains the championship. It's too soon to take that title off of him, but I'll tell you what. Here's what I want. I think Walter needs to go on and continue to have a dominant run because he hasn't been the champion for that long. When did he beat Ricochet? Was it June or July? It wasn't that long ago. I say you keep the Intercontinental title on him for a while. I'm not talking Roman Reigns length. I'm not talking that, you know, as long as he held the NXT UK title. He held that thing for about 700 or 800 days. But you keep it on him until WrestleMania. I want to see them run this match back no sooner than WrestleMania. You do that match not that I would be upset if they wanted to do it again next month, but you got to run this match back at WrestleMania. And at WrestleMania, Sheamus finally gets that win over Walter. Maybe it's Walter's first loss on the main roster. Sheamus wins, and he gets the Intercontinental title that has eluded him his entire career. That's what I would do with those two. That's the perfect time to run it back. Another big stadium show, and this time, Sheamus gets the win. But I love this match. We had Edge and Rey Mysterio teaming up, taking on the Judgment Day, Finn Balor and Damian Priest. Dominic was at ringside, Rhea Ripley was at ringside, and they did things a little bit differently here. I actually liked what they did. Even though the Judgment Day lost, and Finn Balor got pinned, he ate a 619 into a spear and got pinned, Dominic helped his team win. He was very instrumental in Edge and Rey getting the win. When the match was over, though, he looked like he felt left out. He looked like the last kid in dodgeball, you know, to not get picked. Edge and Rey, they're celebrating, and Dominic's off to the side. And I just thought the way that he carried himself and his facial expressions and his mannerisms, he fucking knocked it out of the park. And so the babyfaces win, Dominic helps them, even people who were thinking coming into the show like I was, that this kid's going to go heel, he's going to side with the Judgment Day. When he helped his team win, it almost makes you go, oh, okay, I guess not. But then they lowered the boom when the match was over. And he did kick Edge in the dick, and Edge sold it great, and Rey is trying to talk to him and say, what are you doing? Por favor, what are you doing? And then he clotheslines the hell out of Rey. I mean, he stiffed his fucking father with that clothesline. And he stood there and the booze rained down upon him. He got showered in booze. It got exactly the reaction that they were hoping for. And he walked off. And I thought Dominic carried himself great. I thought what they did there was great. The question is, can he carry a heel promo? That I'm not sure of. I've not seen any evidence of this. But we also haven't seen him cut a promo like that before. So I don't want to reserve judgment until we have, you know, a microphone in this kid's hand and we see what he can do. Maybe on Monday we'll get that heel promo from him. But I thought how they did this actually was very well done. Liv Morgan retained her SmackDown Women's title over Shayna Baszler. I would have put the title on Shayna, but they're continuing the underdog babyface run here for Liv. She won cleanly. There were no shenanigans. There was no trickery involved. That was pretty much as clean of a win as she has gotten since becoming champion. And Bayley, Bianca Belair, looks like that's going to be our next feud for the Raw Women's Championship, exactly as I pitched it in the predictions the other night. Bayley, Dakota Kai, Io Sky, they win in their six-person tag over Bianca, Alexa, and Asuka, and it's Bayley getting the pin on Bianca to set her up now as the new number one contender. The match itself was okay, but it was really just about getting Bayley over as the next challenger for that title. So on the whole, again, not too many matches. You know, it wasn't like a bloated card. They gave time to a lot of the matches. And despite the, you know, obviously to a lot of people, very disappointing ending to the show, I thought that it was an excellent effort overall. Now on Raw tomorrow night, we have a steel cage match. A Labor Day steel cage match. Bobby Lashley defends the United States Championship against The Miz. So here's my question. Does Dexter Lumis come up through the mat and drag Miz down to hell? Right, we've seen that happen a bunch of times before. Because you know he's going to show up. The only question is, does he show up from under the ring? Do the lights go out and he's in the ring? How are they going to do this? Maybe he's climbing out of the cage and he looks down and there's Dexter. Miz has the match won. But he looks down and there's Lumis just standing there. And he's so scared he climbs back into the cage. I guess we'll see. We'll see tomorrow night. AEW All Out is live tonight from the Now Arena in Chicago. 15 matches on this card. Ugh. 15 matches. They're having a zero-hour pre-show, which is the name they usually reserve for their Ring of Honor pre-shows. It's also the name they used for the All-In pre-show 3 years ago in the same building. Eddie Kingston returned from his two-week suspension on Wednesday. He and Sammy Guevara, they found each other backstage, and they talked, and they apologized to each other for what happened between them, and at the end of their discussion, they shook hands and they agreed that their issues were in the past. It's all water under the bridge now. Even though they patched things up, Kingston is no longer wrestling Sammy Guevara on the pay-per-view. That was the first match made official for this show many weeks ago. That is no longer happening. Instead, Kingston has himself a much tougher challenge on the pre-show in Tomohiro Ishii. This is a rematch from the New Japan Capital Collision pay-per-view in May. Ishii won their last match, and so I think Eddie gets his win back here. Also on the pre-show, Hook defends the FTW title against Angelo Parker of the Jericho Appreciation Society. Of course, I have Hook to retain. And Pac will defend his All-Atlantic Championship against Kip Sabian. I mean, this is ridiculous. It should be. Obviously, anything other than Pac winning this match is just fucking ridiculous. So on the main card, we have the casino ladder match. Claudio Castagnoli, Wheeler Yuta, Penta Oscuro, Rey Fénix, Andrade El Idolo, Rush, Dante Martin, and a mystery Joker entrant. Obviously, MJF is going to be the top name on people's lists. It's going to be MJF, they say. And that's their way of getting him a championship match that he could cash in on whenever he wants. Very possible. It would be a simple way to explain how MJF has himself a title match. Because otherwise, why would Tony Khan give him one? And it's not like he's ranked. We haven't seen him on television in 3 months. He could worm his way in there as the Joker. Very possible. I'm not going to go with MJF. I'm not going with MJF. I think the Joker entrant in this ladder match is Samoa Joe. I think he's going to be the Joker in this match. They already have two other Ring of Honor champions in there with Claudio and Yuta. So, I mean, hey, what's one more, right? It's not like the Ring of Honor guys have any other place to go, to be. Joe just wrapped filming for his part on that Twisted Metal TV show. So he's ready to go. I think Joe wins and he challenges CM Punk for the AEW title in Grand Slam on September 21st. FTR and Wardlow team up to take on Jay Lethal and the Motor City Machine Guns. Would have made a lot more sense to have the Briscoes in that spot, but we know why that can't happen. Actually, what would have made a lot more sense is to have FTR against the Young Bucks for all the gold, but the Bucks traded their AEW tag team titles for trios belts. So that's not going to happen. But we are getting FTR and the Machine Guns for the first time. That's going to be great. This should not be anything other than a victory for FTR and Wardlow. I'm sure either Alex Shelley or Chris Sabin will be the one to take the losing fall. That way, Jay Lethal is protected for his rematch with Wardlow for the TNT title. A TNT champion that has definitely been cooled off since the match with MJF at Double or Nothing. If Wardlow is going to powerbomb Satnam Singh at some point, it should not be here. They should save that moment for a show like Grand Slam in a few weeks. Maybe that's where they do Wardlow against Lethal. And Wardlow could powerbomb the big guy after the match. Because I don't need to see them wrestle. We do not need a Wardlow-Satnam Singh match. But I think to see him powerbomb the guy, if he thinks he can do it, you know, it would be a great visual for him. I would do that at Arthur Ashe. I wouldn't do that here. Ricky Starks one-on-one with Powerhouse Hobbs. I'm looking forward to this. This should be a Ricky Starks win, I think. I would give it to Ricky Starks. Starks has a huge upside. I mean, Hobbs has a big upside too, but I think Starks could be a real money player for them. And I think he needs a big win here. I would give it to him. Sammy Guevara and Ty Conti, or Ty Mello, I guess is her name now, take on Ortiz and Ruby Soho for the AAA Mixed Tag Team titles. Actually, I think this might be on the pre-show, but I listed it here for some reason. But the AAA Mixed Tag Team titles are on the line. Both teams are one win apiece. Sammy and Ty won 2 weeks ago. Ruby and Ortiz got a win on Rampage on Friday night. Ruby rolled up Ty. I don't think they're dropping their AAA titles, so I'm going to go with Sammy and Ty to retain. Jade Cargill defends her TBS championship and her undefeated streak against Athena. And it sucks that Chris Statlander got hurt because this should have been her spot. And I think it would have been her spot. But if she can't be the one to beat Jade, and actually I think, where is she from? Is she from Long Island? I think she's from Long Island. So I'm not even sure if they would have done the match here that she would have won the title, but I think maybe they were thinking about building up something at Grand Slam. But anyway, that went out the window with her torn ACL. So she's out of the picture. If she's not going to be the one to beat Jade, then it should be Athena. Because it's not like they have any other viable options right now anyway. You know, the only thing I'm unsure of is if they do it here, or do they have the baddies cost Athena the match and then run it back in a few weeks in Queens, with the baddies being banned from ringside. I'm going to go with the latter. I'm going to go with that second scenario. I'm predicting that Jade retains the TBS title here. We're already guaranteed one new women's champion on this show anyway. I think they could save this one for New York. We've got Sting, Darby Allin, and Miro taking on the House of Black. I'm going to talk about Malakai Black here in a few minutes. I think the House of Black need to go over here. They already lost in the opening round of the Trios tournament, and Malakai was the one who took the losing fall, no less, to the Dark Order, which is ridiculous. This should be a House of Black win, no question about it. And I mean, if it's me, I have Malakai be the first person to hand Sting a pinfall loss in AEW. Christian Cage goes one-on-one with Jungle Boy. That's going to be great. I think Jungle Boy gets the win. With Thunder Rosa stepping down as the AEW Women's Champion, an interim champion will be crowned in a four-way. It'll be Toni Storm, Britt Baker, Jamie Hayter, and Hikaru Shida. And the tag team match on Dynamite was very good, actually, with all four women. But it had Shida pinning Britt Baker. And that worries me. Because I would not have Britt Baker winning this match. I really don't want to see Britt Baker win this title. I think Baker and Hayter, they're going to double-cross each other or in some way cost each other a win. That leads to Tony Storm taking the title and hopefully the start of a split between Hayter and Baker. They could start that story. But I think Tony Storm will be the interim AEW Women's Champion until Thunder Rosa comes back, and then they could do the match they originally planned to do. Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland defend the AEW Tag Team titles against the Acclaimed. This should be a win for Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland. I would wait. I would not do the title change yet. I would not put the belts on the Acclaimed yet. Give it a few more months. We have Lionheart Chris Jericho one-on-one with the American Dragon, Bryan Danielson, in a battle for the soul of Daniel Garcia. On Dynamite, we had a match between Danielson and Jake Hager, which turned into a pretty good match. And Danielson got the win, and, you know, again, the way that they were kind of using Garcia on this show, my mind hasn't really changed. Plus the fact that Garcia is wrestling Wheeler Yuta of the Blackpool Combat Club for the Ring of Honor Pure title on Dynamite this week. I definitely still think that he's going to be siding with Chris Jericho, that it's all a ruse, and he's going to in some way cost Danielson the match. I don't think Garcia's going anywhere, and I think Jericho gets the win. We have the finals of the tournament to crown new AEW Trios Tag Team Champions. Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks take on Hangman Page and the Dark Order. Dark Order beat Best Friends on Rampage this week, so they move on to the finals. This is the story. They've been building this story for a while, right? And, on BTE and all the Elite stuff, and now Hangman is in the match, so they can tell that story. We had Kenny Omega and Will Ospreay in the ring together. They shared a ring in a trios match on Dynamite, and it was fucking great. They need to run that back as a singles match at the Tokyo Dome. I would think New Japan wants that match. That's why they probably won't do it in Queens, but if not Grand Slam, that's got to be a Tokyo Dome match. But I think, look, this whole thing has been built up for Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks to be the Trios champions. I don't see that changing. I think this will be a great match, but I think the outcome is no different than I expected it to be when they first announced these titles. I was hoping the House of Black would get those belts, but once they got bounced, it was pretty clear to me that we're probably getting Omega and the Bucks going over here. And in the main event, Jon Moxley defends his newly unified AEW World Championship against the former champion in his hometown of Chicago, CM Punk. So they did what they did a couple of weeks ago. And they had the match, and Punk got squashed in 3 minutes, and it shocked everybody. And, you know, it was a ratings stunt, and it paid off for them. And so this week, they ended up having dueling promos. Moxley had a chance to cut a promo. Punk came out, and he was looking very down and very depressed and talking about his foot and how he came back too soon. And Ace Steele, his trainer and his best friend, came out to the ring. And basically what they did is Moxley had a contract, an open contract. Anybody who wanted to come out and sign the contract can do so to challenge him at All Out. And a few minutes later, it was Ace Steele, who doesn't even wrestle for them. He's a fucking producer backstage. He comes to the ring, picks up the contract that Moxley left on the mat, and took it to the back with him. Why there weren't wrestlers tripping over each other to run out there and sign that contract, I have no idea. I still maintain that was very dumb. But they had CM Punk come out. Ace Steele eventually came out and it was really trying to talk some sense into him and said, look, I don't know where this is coming from because you and I had a totally different conversation about this in the back. And basically, you know, you got to wake up, basically, is what he was trying to say to him. And he dropped an F-bomb in here. He was trying to psych up Punk. And he dropped an F-bomb. He said, you know, when you get knocked down, you fucking get up. And he slapped him across the face. And so he did this, and I even said during the review on Wednesday, I said, TBS ain't going to be happy about that. I go, there goes some money into the swear jar, because he got fined. He got fined an undisclosed amount of money for dropping that F-bomb. And this is after an email went out to all the talent this week with all the events that are happening in Chicago tied into the pay-per-view. One of the points that was made in this email was not to use expletives on Dynamite or Rampage this week. And then this guy goes out there and drops an F-bomb on live television. So according to PW Insider, as soon as Ace Steel got to the back after the segment was over, he took responsibility for what happened and he agreed to a fine that will be donated to charity. So it's all good. But that's what they did. And then Punk ended up signing the contract and he went out into the crowd and he cut this impassioned promo about people from Chicago. And so that was their way of going about building up the rematch. I still think that it was unnecessary to do the match on TV, but look, it got them above a million viewers. And I said, you could throw that rating away. The rating that is more interesting to me is what number they did this past week. And when the numbers came in, they stayed above a million viewers for the second week in a row. So they did not chase away any viewers with the finish that they did the week before. So that's a good sign. I think CM Punk is winning the AEW World Championship. I really don't see any way that Moxley walks out of there with the belt. I think Punk goes over, he wins the title. Do we see MJF at the end of the show? I'm going to say yes. I do think that MJF will return tonight, and that will set the stage for everything that is going to happen now in the next few months here in the fall on television, which is a very critical period for AEW because their television rights next year are going to be coming up for renewal. There's going to be that negotiation period. That's a very, very important deal. They want to not only renew, but they want to make more. They want to make more money on this next deal than they had on the current deal. And the way that you do that is by showing the network that you can maintain strong ratings. So them getting back their main eventers like Kenny Omega, Adam Cole should be back soon, Punk is back, MJF should be back any day now. They're all coming back at a very critical period for Tony Khan. So these next few months are going to be very important to the future of AEW. It's possible that with all of his time off that MJF had, that he was watching a lot of movies on Netflix. He's going to want to hear this. You've heard me talk about ExpressVPN and how you need to be using it to protect yourself online, but you can also use it to unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries. I am about to blow your mind. I went to go watch Goodfellas the other day. Great movie. Casino's a great one too. Two Scorsese films, both with De Niro and Pesci, but I got to go with Goodfellas. Only I couldn't, because it left Netflix on Wednesday. You believe that? Thankfully, I'm a smart guy. I fired up my ExpressVPN app and I switched my location to France, like I'm Carmen Sandiego. I refresh Netflix and there it was. The Goodfellas are back. ExpressVPN lets you control where you want sites to think that you're located. You can choose from almost 100 different countries. That's a lot of Netflix libraries. If you love Korean dramas, use ExpressVPN to watch Parasite on South Korean Netflix. If you like scary movies, there's always Halloween on Netflix in Brazil. And it's not Netflix. It's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service. Hulu? Got it. YouTube? Absolutely. Guys, there are hundreds of VPNs out there, like a lot of them. The reason that I use ExpressVPN is because it's ridiculously fast. I never have buffering. I never have lag issues. I can watch my shows and movies in beautiful HD, and it works on all my devices. So I can watch it from home. I can watch it on the go, pretty much anywhere I want. So if you want access to hundreds of new shows and movies, go to expressvpn.com/solomonster right now, and you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. ExpressVPN.com/Solomonster to learn more. Tony Khan held a presser on Thursday to promote All Out and had a few interesting things to say. He said that Rampage will be going live in October and November, and he's planning on loading those shows up. He said with all the current injuries and recent injuries, he needed his key people on Dynamite, and that came at the expense of Rampage. So he's acknowledging that Rampage has... And he would never use these exact words, but Rampage has basically become a throwaway show, which is exactly what it has become. He said he wants a reset. He wants to bring the numbers up. And if he wants to bring the numbers up, he's going to have to start using bigger names on the show. Not just the lower card talents and not just filling it up with squash matches. He was on Wrestling Observer Radio yesterday. He revealed that the Rampage Grand Slam episode that they're taping at Arthur Ashe Stadium after Dynamite, that's going to be a two-hour show again, just like it was last year. He said CM Punk's injury ruined plans for a tag team match that they would have done on TV a couple of weeks before the Forbidden Door show, with CM Punk and FTR teaming up to take on Will Ospreay and Aussie Open. He was asked about Thunder Rosa not getting as much time for her promo announcing her injury as CM Punk did when he had his injury. You know, Punk got 8 minutes for an in-ring promo while Rosa got a quick backstage segment with Tony Schiavone. And he gave an honest answer, but I knew the minute that I heard it that it was going to cause a shitstorm online. He said, look, an 8-minute CM Punk promo is going to do better numbers than an 8-minute Thunder Rosa promo, which is true. And I know that some people aren't going to want to hear that, but that doesn't make it any less true. CM Punk is the biggest attraction in AEW. He's the biggest star that they have. He just won their world championship and did not even get to defend it once before he got hurt. Now he had to step back, have surgery on his foot. It was a big deal. That's not something you throw out there in a 30-second segment. And Thunder Rosa, I like Thunder Rosa, but she's not going to go out there and carry an 8-minute segment like CM Punk. Should they have done the segment in the ring instead of just doing it in the back? Yeah, probably they should have. But I wasn't hot and bothered by it, I guess, like some of these other people were. He also said that they knew days in advance about the Punk situation and were able to allocate 8 minutes to him for the promo, whereas with Thunder Rosa, he only found out about it from her a few hours before the show that night, before they were going on the air. The whole show was already laid out for that night. There was nothing inaccurate about what he was saying, but there were better, more diplomatic ways for him to word it so as not to upset his own talent. That's a PR thing. He does shoot himself in the foot sometimes unnecessarily. His response to Big Swole on Twitter is a great example of that from all those many months ago. But there were no lies in what Tony Khan said. That doesn't change the fact that the booking of the women's division and also of Thunder Rosa's reign as champion has been terrible. He does bear responsibility for that. And he's got a lot of work to do to improve that. But there were no lies in what he said. Now, there has been a lot of talk in the last few days about multiple AEW stars asking for their releases. I know Miro was one name thrown around, and there is no legitimate reporting to back up that claim. But the one name where there does appear to be smoke to the fire is Malakai Black. Raj Giri of Wrestling Inc. said that Black cited personal issues and his mental health as reasons for wanting out, and the way that he's been presented in AEW has also been weighing on him, but thus far, Tony Khan has not granted him his release. Only a few months ago, Tony Khan was on Busted Open Radio openly talking about Malakai Black and Adam Cole each being signed to 5-year deals. So he's under contract for a long time yet, right? He's got about 4 years left on a 5-year deal. Mike Johnson, a PW Insider, said that in speaking with sources close to Malakai, there has been a personal situation of some kind weighing heavily on him, and he has privately discussed taking a long, possibly even permanent break from pro wrestling to deal with those issues. Now, whatever the personal issue is, that has to take priority over pro wrestling. So I hope everything works out okay on that front. You know, you hear something like that, you think, oh my God, maybe there's a sick family member, maybe it's a health issue. I don't know, and frankly, it's none of my business, but whatever it is, I hope everything works out okay. Physically, he worked the House of Glory show last weekend. He looked fine. He's in a 6-man tag team match tonight against Sting and Darby and Miro. So I haven't seen him do any kind of singles match probably since the All-Atlantic 4-Way back at Forbidden Door, which was, you know, over 2 months ago. But physically, he seems to be doing a lot better. I know he had the back issue. He thought that might be the end of his career. That's how bad of a back issue he's been dealing with up until about 3 months ago. But he's been doing better recently. The idea of him being less than enthused with the way that he's been booked in AEW, that doesn't surprise me at all, if that's true. I've been critical of how the House of Black has been used, but I also don't know how much of that had to do with the back injury that he was dealing with. How little we have seen him used on television in recent months, that could be a big part of it for all we know. They had something special with him after he beat Cody Rhodes, coming out of the Cody feud, and they never capitalized on it. They never took it to the max the way that they could have. All of the additional talent that Tony Khan brought in has only further, reduced the amount of TV time that he's been given. As much as I like the House of Black idea, I said it when they first formed. You guys remember, the one big negative will be if Tony Khan stops using him as a single, and we really only get to see him in tag team matches or trios matches, and that is exactly what's happened. That's exactly what I did not want to see happen. Now again, maybe the back issue had something to do with that. Until he posted about it, I had no idea that it almost caused him to retire. But, Black is a very creative guy, very similar to the things you hear said about Bray Wyatt. He has to be frustrated with how things have gone so far. But if he has spent much of the past 6 months to a year nursing a bad back, and that's why he really hasn't been used much, and now he wants a release, it's a tricky thing for AEW. I can understand both sides of it, him wanting out and Tony Khan saying no. The difference with someone like Mustafa Ali, for example, asking for his WWE release and being denied is that WWE was cutting people left and right. They were cutting so many people, we lost count after a while, all the mass releases last year. And it was very clear that they had no real plans for him, and yet they said no. They said no out of spite. Pure spite. Brody Lee asking for his release and having to wait a year before they finally gave it to him. And for what? They had already given up on the guy. Vince McMahon gave up on him. He soured on him. I do think that in certain situations, if one side is completely miserable coming to work and wants out, and if the company has no intention of using them in any meaningful way, or they've tried to push them, and whether it was their fault or the talent's fault, they gave up on them, it didn't work out, then contract or not, there's no reason to belabor things. If you can come to some sort of mutual agreement and let the person go and be happy, then do it. Because nobody is going to be happy in that situation. And you got 3 years or 4 years left on your deal. I mean, what the fuck is the point? I think Tony Khan does see value in Malakai Black, but he should be used better. He should be featured more consistently on the shows. It's been a little bit better lately. House of Black has been feuding with Sting and Darby and Miro. I think Malakai should pin Sting tonight, like I said before, and win the match for the House of Black. Really make a statement by becoming the first man to pin Sting shoulders to the mat in an AEW ring. Unless he really wants out that badly, and then I think the two sides need to sit down and work something out. According to Fightful, people in the company said that Black has not been happy, but they thought the situation had been somewhat smoothed over. I hope that's the case. And then there was one. The last time we saw Adam Cole, Kyle O'Reilly, and Bobby Fish together on Dynamite was August 3rd when they attacked the Young Bucks. It looked like we were finally building to Cole and Red Dragon against the Elite, especially with Kenny Omega coming back. They could still do a Kenny Omega-Adam Cole match, but they're going to have to do it without Red Dragon. Kyle O'Reilly posted an image of himself in a hospital bed on Thursday night on his Instagram, indicating that he underwent neck fusion surgery, which if that's what it was, means that we're not going to be seeing him for a very long time. And meanwhile, his partner, Bobby Fish, has swam away from AEW. He is gone altogether. How much fish can Bobby Fish fry if Bobby Fish could fry fish? Well, he's going to have plenty of free time to find out now and try it and see. The two sides could not come to terms on a new deal, and his current deal expired on Wednesday. So he is a free agent. He can go wherever he wants. He can do whatever he wants, although the door is set to still be open for the two sides to possibly come to an agreement later on. He talked recently about an incident with him and Dax Harwood. They got into it about something. He didn't say what. And I'm not sure how far back this incident goes. It could be 6 months ago for all I know. But there was some incident between them. He said even though there would still be animosity and conflict between them if they worked together, they would be professional about it. So I don't think that had anything to do with him leaving. When he came to AEW last year, he was floundering. And I swear I didn't use that word on purpose in that context. Oh, that's almost as good as my Kaiser roll joke on the SmackDown stream the other night, which I'm so proud of. But no, I mean, he was floundering until they brought Kyle O'Reilly in. You know, and that's what I wanted to see. I didn't give a shit about Bobby Fish, the solo act. I wanted to see Red Dragon back together, going after the tag team titles. He also said recently in an interview that he would go to war for Triple H 7 days a week. He really put Triple H over as a boss. And with Triple H bringing back so many black and gold talents, I could see him going back there. But to do what? To coach? If they use him in the ring, it's not going to be for anything other than putting over the younger NXT talents. I mean, maybe they could tie him in with Roddy and the Diamond Mine stuff, but there isn't much else for him to do. Bobby Fish on his own is not going to be somebody pushed in any real way. The Cole story could be interesting, though, if they position it as Adam Cole, you know, his friends are all gone, and he finds himself all alone because he already went and betrayed the Young Bucks. So they could tell that story. You know, Cole's been out hurt for a while. He is expected back soon, though. AEW Full Gear is scheduled to take place at the Prudential Center in Newark, New Jersey. The rumored date, per The Observer, is Saturday, November 19th. Which is the week before Survivor Series. Newark is where they were supposed to do the first Blood and Guts match until COVID just went and shut everything down. They had 14,000 tickets already sold for that show before that. We'll see if they can move 14,000 this time. And there was controversy this week over FTR being pulled from the AEW video game. This was apparently news. FTR was asked about it during an interview with Louis Dangor of the website Give Me Sport, and said that it was a non-issue. They've known about this since March, and they're not sure why all of a sudden this became news in August. They first heard about this before their first match with the Briscoes, and that was back at the beginning of April. And at the time, when they heard about it, they texted Tony Khan and AEW Legal, and they got their answer, which they said made sense to them, and there was no heat over it, and that was that. My guess is AEW is going to work on a Ring of Honor DLC for the game after it comes out, and you know, given that they're the Ring of Honor tag team champions, they'll be part of that, probably with Claudio and Samoa Joe and Jay Lethal and the Briscoes and maybe a few others. Absolutely, I could see them doing a Ring of Honor specific DLC pack. So that would be my guess. Some kind of DLC. I think this is much ado about nothing, and apparently FTR feels the same way. So I was shocked by how upset people were about this video game shit this week. As if it meant, like, people were building it up like, oh, this is a bad sign. FTR must be on bad terms. They're leaving. FTR must be walking out on AEW. It's like, and then they talk about, they're like, we knew about this in March. You people are late to the game. It's not a big deal. But it's amazing, you know, these days what becomes news. Triple H sat down with Ariel Helwani in Cardiff and gave his longest interview since taking over as the head of creative. Over an hour long, they covered a lot of topics. I'll just get into some of them here. He did talk about his health issues, and it's always scary to hear him talk about this and just how close he came to death. So he talked again, you know, some of what he talked about with Stephen A. Smith on ESPN earlier this year. But he did add a few other details to the story. He said, you know, he suffered a slight V-fib, which is a heart flutter. And he was told that he would need a defibrillator implanted in his chest. And there were a couple of different ways they could go about doing it. They were going to go with option A, and it shouldn't be overly complicated. It should be one procedure. It shouldn't be more than an hour or so. He ended up needing two different surgeries totaling 15 hours to have this fucking thing implanted. The first surgery took 7.5 hours and it was just filled with nothing but complications. And after they went through all that, they realized that the device still didn't work. So they had to do a second surgery the next day that lasted over 8 hours. And again, nothing but complications. And I think again, the thing didn't work. And I think at that point they went to option B, whatever that was. Maybe it was more invasive. I mean, this whole thing sounds invasive. So he was saying, you know, it was a problem because he was very vascular from years of training and his tissue was very thick and they have to dig in there. And they said it was just very difficult. But eventually he had it, implanted. He said that before he came back to the company earlier this year, he underwent a medical checkup and got a clean bill of health. He said, before I came back at WrestleMania, I go to the doctor, I get the checkup, and they walk into the room and they say, your ejection fraction is over 50. And his ejection fraction, which, again, you want it to be at that level, he was, when he was sick, like near death, it was dropping fast. It was in the 20s, and then it got down to as low as 12. So for it to be back up above 50 is basically a 100% recovery. And he said the doctors told him that there's no guarantee it'll ever go back up to that level. It maybe only goes back up to 30, but you could still live a normal life, but you may never get back up to where it was. And apparently it is back to where it was. But very scary stuff. And you know, it's also scary to think about. If the worst had happened, and he died as a result of all this, and then things play out this summer the way they did with Vince McMahon, and he resigns, who would be running creative right now? Probably Bruce. It's very likely Bruce Pritchard would be the one running WWE creative right now. Think about that. So thank God he made it through. He also revealed that the original plan, they had a plan in place for him to work a match at WrestleMania this year in Dallas. And the plan was for him to do something with Gable Steveson to try to get him launched and get him going. Remember, Steveson was drafted. He was the final draft pick in the draft last fall. It was Gable Steveson going to Monday Night Raw. And the idea was when he finished out his wrestling career, his amateur career, sometime in the spring, we would see him pop up on Monday Night Raw. Well, interestingly, there has not been a peep about Gable Steveson. And there was even a note in the Observer this week that things have gone cold. There's been no talk about him at all. His brother Bobby is in NXT. He's part of Diamond Mine, Damon Kemp. He apparently is getting high marks. He's doing well, but there has been zero said about Gable Steveson. I don't know if things are dead on that front. That would be quite the come down, though, to go from a potential match with Triple H at WrestleMania to people not even talking about him anymore. But that was the plan. Probably when they drafted him to Raw, they had this preliminary plan, or maybe a little bit earlier than that. You know, hey, how'd you like to work with him? It's like, yeah, okay. And then he got sick and had to retire. So obviously that whole plan went out the window. But yeah, there's been nothing said about Gable Steveson recently. He confirmed the internet reports that Brock Lesnar did in fact walk out of SmackDown the day that he found out about Vince McMahon's resignation. He claimed there was some truth to that. He couldn't even bring himself to say, yeah, that's what happened. He goes, oh, there's some truth to what happened there. He can use whatever word he wants. There are some people who are owed an apology for being shit on the way that they were and dismissed after they reported what happened. He said Brock had a moment of doubt. And they had a conversation later on. He did come back to the building and he did do business. He said when Lesnar first came back to the company in 2012, he, as in Triple H, was the guy that he was dealing with directly because there was still a lot of heat with him and Vince and the way that he left the company and the lawsuits and everything else. But over time, they repaired their relationship and Vince was the guy that Brock would deal with directly. He wouldn't deal with Triple H anymore. He wouldn't deal with anybody else. He would go right to Vince if he had a question or something. He would text Vince or call Vince. It was all through Vince. And I wish Ariel would have followed up and asked him if Brock is done now or if he still has time left on his deal, because we haven't heard anything about Brock Lesnar since SummerSlam. But he didn't follow up. He didn't ask about Lesnar's status coming out of the show. He assured us that Vince McMahon has no involvement in the day-to-day operations of WWE or any sane creative. He hears the same things that people are talking about, how, oh, Vince is basically running a shadow government in the background and he's still pulling the strings and texting ideas and stuff. Triple H claims that's not the case. And honestly, anybody who watches WWE programming in the last month, it should be pretty clear that Vince McMahon has no involvement in creative. That should be pretty clear at this point. He said Vince gave him a piece of advice once. He told him, put yourself in the seats. Book like a fan. Book it like a fan and you'll never go wrong. Which is fucking hilarious when you consider for so long how they booked for an audience of one. Tony Khan books like a fan. And he gets shit on all the time for it. But the idea of Vince McMahon saying that you know, you should book it like a fan. That is one of the funnier things that he, Triple H said during the interview. I'm sure Vince actually did tell him that, but that he would actually believe it and would practice what he preaches is absolutely priceless. Then he talked about the NXT stuff, and this is what got a lot of people talking this week. He was asked if he felt that the rebranding of NXT, the move to 2.0, was punishment for losing the Wednesday Night War to AEW. He goes, no, people put so much pressure on this competitive war. It was never that. First of all, they beat our developmental system. Good for them. No, it was never that. There was never, ever pressure to, you know, you have to beat that, you have to beat them. It was just put on the best product that you could. Now, that, of course, is the kind of answer that you would expect Triple H to say. What else is he going to say? Is he going to come right out and say, yeah, there was some competitive, you know, juices flowing there? Of course not. He's going to give the corporate stock answer. And if he was punished for it, and you know that Vince McMahon looked at that and had to be disappointed and say, man, if this guy can't carry the load against AEW on, you know, on Wednesdays, how is this guy going to run Raw and SmackDown one day? Little did he know that he would have no choice but to step aside and Triple H would take over anyway a year later, or 2 years later. But, you know, the reality is Triple H is the one who put those quotes out there. And I know it's been circulating on social media, so, you know, you don't need me to play it for you. You've heard, and he said it more than once, too. Going back 5-6 years about this is no longer developmental. Of course, there are going to be developmental talents that were on the NXT show that they want to get them in the ring to work with people like Finn Balor and to work with people like Adrian Neville and Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens and all of those guys, Adam Cole, all those guys, right? But the vast majority of the talent that you saw on that NXT show for years, they were not developmental talent. They were established talents who already came in with experience, who were being groomed for call-ups eventually to the main roster. A lot of the people that you see right now on the main roster came out of NXT, but they were not developed in NXT. Some of them were. Bianca Belair, Rhea Ripley, there are success stories that you can point to, but a lot of them were not. Triple H went out there and he said, this is no longer developmental. This is a third brand. You have Raw, you have SmackDown, and now you have number three that happens to be called NXT. That is how he chose to promote the brand for the longest time. That is what he said. Those were his words. And when NXT won the Battle of the Brands at Survivor Series 3 years ago, Raw and SmackDown didn't get beat by developmental. So I heard what he said there, and I just thought to myself, man, what a burial of that NXT talent roster at the time, the way he just dismissed it like that. Oh, you beat our developmental system. Good for you. I wonder what those guys think, and those girls think, the ones who believed in all the bullshit that he said and all the rah-rah speeches and rallying the troops and all that, and we're not developmental, we are NXT, you know, and part of that was just him being a promoter, I'm sure, and trying to just get everybody fired up and believing in his vision. But what a burial of the talent on that roster. Now NXT is a full-on developmental show, absolutely. But at the time, it was developmental only when it was convenient for them to call it developmental. And when it wasn't, it was their third brand on national television on USA Network. For him to say that as passive-aggressively as he did, he is being disingenuous. And I'm sure part of it also is that it still burns him that they got beat and they got bounced over to Tuesdays. It was embarrassing for him. In their minds, I'm sure they thought that this is going to be easy. You know, this is going to be like cake. We're WWE. We're a global brand. We have a heads up. We already have a leg up and a head start on these guys. This is not going to be all that difficult. Well, turned out to be a lot more difficult than they expected. You don't think that these people didn't get a bruised ego based on what happened there in the head-to-head with AEW? So, of course, that played a role in it. Now, Triple H is not the only one to make dumb comments. Chris Jericho last summer flat out said that, oh, we're 3 to 6 months away, max, from Dynamite beating Monday Night Raw. It became pretty clear that wasn't going to happen, and now there's even less of a chance of that happening. Now that Raw is back over 2 million viewers, although they might go back down now that Monday Night Football is starting. But Raw now is having this rebirth. It's having this renaissance. Even when Raw was at its lowest, they still never beat Raw. There were some demo numbers where they may have beaten them or they tied them or whatever, but didn't work out the way Chris Jericho said that it was going to work out. And Jericho was really pissed about Triple H's comments when he was asked about them on Inside the Ropes on Friday. Let me read you his response here. He said, "Once again, it's just changing the narrative and changing the history, which makes me laugh." And that part of it, by the way, he's not telling lies. That part of it is true. He says, because when it started, it was not developmental. It was a third brand. It's not a sprint. It's a marathon and all the other bullshit they said. So, of course, we beat the developmental or whatever you want to call it. But who gives a shit? It's such old news and the show sucks. NXT sucks. It's not a good show. And they know it. Whether they were punished or not, they probably were punished. That's probably why Triple H said those things, because he is angry that we beat them, and he is probably angry that we exist. But you know, we don't care about WWE. We care about our show. We care about putting on the best stories that we can put on. We care about building our fan base and building our ratings. We will continue to exist, and I will tell you this, my boss has a lot more money than his boss does. A lot more. So you want to go to that, and we are not going anywhere. We will continue to grow. That pisses them off, and why wouldn't it? They had a monopoly for so long and don't like the fact that we exist, and that's fine. We don't care that they exist. God bless them. They are running a show in front of 50,000 people. Why would he care about us? But you know, he should, and he does, and that's why he said those things. He was kind of all over the place. I don't know where that came from about how my boss has more money than your boss. I have no fucking idea what that's supposed to mean. I mean, that's like my dick is bigger than your dick. Who gives a shit? But you know, I have to say this. For a company that doesn't care about WWE, Chris Jericho says, hey, we in AEW, we don't care about WWE. We don't think about them. We focus on our own. You know, for a company that doesn't care about WWE, they sure do mention them a lot. They sure do mention them a lot. They always have them on the tip of their tongue. So Jericho didn't do himself any favors with that interview either. Ariel threw out some names for Triple H to talk about as far as potential returns on Sasha Banks. He said time will tell. Said there was a communication breakdown, but that she is supremely talented and she could do whatever she wants. It just comes down to what she wants to do right now. He asked about Braun Strowman, and he said that we'll see. He called him a polarizing person sometimes, but for a guy his size and what he brings to the table, he said he's an amazing athlete. If this is what he wants to do at the highest of levels, then I would like nothing more than to give him another shot. The PW Insider is reporting that Braun Strowman is already back with WWE, and he will be at Raw tomorrow night in Kansas City. I guess he is done controlling his narrative. Narrative controlled. Mission accomplished. His release was shocking in that he was always positioned at or near the top of the card. So like a Bray Wyatt, you know, when they release a big name like that, it's going to be very surprising. Doesn't happen very often. And people shit on Braun. I've shit on him for some of the dumb stuff that he said on social media in the past. But there was a period of time in 2017 where the guy was on fire. He and Seth Rollins both. They were the two most over baby faces on that roster. He was getting the monster push. And they should have belted him. And instead he got mowed down by Brock Lesnar at No Mercy with one F5. Just like everybody else. Just another guy. And that was that, and Brock moved on. Brock's like a tornado. And Braun got sucked up into the tornado, and after all the damage was done and the debris was strewn all over the place, the tornado moved on to the next victim. Now, eventually, they did put the title on him, but that was years later. It was too late. He wasn't nearly as over by then. Now he's been gone for almost a year. They say absence makes the heart grow fonder. I know he's gotten himself in tremendous shape. I've seen the pictures. Triple H is looking for names, and Braun Strowman still has a name. Strowman would not have worked in AEW, and Tony Khan was not interested in bringing him in, obviously, or else he would have. WWE is where he made his name. He would not have been at the top of my list, but I'm okay with giving him another chance. People saying, oh, Braun can't work. He sucks. For a guy his size, Braun Strowman actually moves around very well. He's not terrible. He's not Omos. Omos is terrible. Braun Strowman in the ring is not terrible. And Omos is, which is why he's all but disappeared from television. When they use Strowman as a monster doing power spots and feats of strength and things like that, that's what got him over. And maybe it can again. His feud with Roman Reigns was great. It's what put him on the map. Just because you don't like the guy, let's not pretend that everything he did sucked and he was terrible. They got rid of him largely to get rid of his fat contract. They were paying him a ton of money. I'm sure whatever they signed him for, it was a lot less this time around. Triple H was asked about Bray Wyatt. This is what he said about Bray. One of the most, and I mean this in the best way possible, one of the most crazy creative people I've ever been around. Mind just never stops thinking of creative, but it's like being in a whirlwind of stuff. So without the harness and without someone to point the tornado, it's just all over the place. He's a victim of his own mind and creative, but I love working with him. Per Fightful, Bray is said to have a serious standing offer from a startup wrestling company that is believed to be the company that Freddie Prinze Jr. has talked about starting. The one where he was going to have Killer Kross as his first world champion until he got the call to go back to WWE. Maybe Bray is his next choice to be champion. But if Bray gets the call to come back to WWE, you know Freddie is going to be 0-2. And he was also asked about The Rock. And Triple H said that he believes The Rock wants to return for a big show like WrestleMania, but it all boils down to his schedule and what he wants to do. He said, look, LA, two nights, the tribal chief or whoever he wants to work with, it's all up to him. He said the clock is ticking because he's not getting any younger. He looks like $1 million, but when you get older, he said things start falling off your body that aren't supposed to fall off. What exactly is falling off your body when you get... That's a weird way of putting it. Should I be worried? Because there are certain parts of my body that I would not want to fall off. I wish he would have been more specific about that. But, yeah, I mean, last time Rock wrestled against John Cena at WrestleMania, muscles were falling off this guy. He ended up going under the knife. I know it delayed production on whatever movie he was working on or about to work on. And that's always been the concern. All right, we've heard about how there's insurance concerns. But with Rock, it really just boils down to how busy he is. Can he fit it in? It's not just one match. People think, oh, well, he could certainly, it's one night out of the entire calendar year. Why can't he fit it in? It's not just one match. He's got to make appearances on television. He needs to promote it. He's going to go out there and do media. It's a whole fucking thing, like making a movie. Sometimes people lose sight of that. It's not a one-night commitment. It's like a 2 or 3 month commitment. Does he have time for that? That's always been the issue. And, you know, when Rock had that match with John Cena at WrestleMania 29, he was 41 years old when he had all the muscle tears and the injuries and had to go have surgery. He was 41 years old. Next year, he's going to be 51. And that's 51 having not done a proper match in a decade. I don't count the 6 seconds with Eric Rowan. So whatever Rock decides, he's going to have to let them know soon so they can begin to prepare for WrestleMania and figure out creatively what their plans are for Roman Reigns. Are we looking at Roman Reigns and The Rock, which is the biggest possible match they could do? Are we looking at Roman Reigns and Cody Rhodes? They're going to have to know. Rock can't pick up the phone in February and say, hey guys, I'll have an answer for you soon. They're going to have an answer in the next few months. It's a pretty good interview, especially the discussion about his health scare last year. I would recommend giving it a watch, even with some of the ridiculous comments that were in there. It was largely a very good interview. And you know, I think Triple H, what you're going to see, and we saw it after the Clash at the Castle show, they had a press conference. And so I will be very curious to see if this becomes the norm, if they do this for all of their pay-per-views going forward, where he just makes himself more accessible. He's taking more of the Dana White approach as opposed to the Vince McMahon approach. He already had the relationship with the wrestling media from doing those conference calls in NXT. So I think Triple H is going to want to be a lot more open than Vince McMahon was. Now, Bronson Reed is not a name that came up in the interview with Ariel, but Bronson Reed is another name that Triple H is said to have interest in possibly bringing back to WWE. He has been working as Jonah on the Independence since he got fired. Jonah has been working with New Japan as well. And he just pinned Kazuchika fucking Okada in the G1 climax. That's huge. I think Okada has lost maybe three singles matches all year total. And Jonah is one of those losses. They wouldn't do that with just anybody. Now, Okada ended up winning the G1, and he's very likely going to win back the IWGP Championship, which sets Jonah up for an eventual IWGP title match, you know, should that happen. But he's been killing it over there. He impressed the hell out of me in that match with Okada. He could be New Japan's new monster. I don't know how his deal is structured, if he would even be able to go to WWE if he wanted to. But I hope he stays right where he is. I don't want to see him go back to WWE right now. I want to see him do his thing with New Japan. I want to see him kill it over there, maybe for a year or two, build his name up even more, and he can eventually go back if he wants to. He can go back to WWE as an even bigger name than when he got released. You know, he got a raw deal the first time there. I am sure that a very big part of him is going to want to go back to WWE because it was left unresolved. Think about the way that his career ended there. He got a raw deal. He was someone who seemed destined for the main roster. So much so that they took the North American title off of him in NXT very quickly after he won it. Not because they lost faith in him, but because Triple H thought he was being called up. He got the call up for some tryout matches, and the NXT, you know, brain trust, they thought he was about to move on up. And they wanted to get the belt off of him first. Turns out Vince McMahon wasn't impressed, and he did get the call. It just wasn't the call that he was expecting. It was a call from Johnny Hot Pants telling him that he was being released, and as he tells the story, Bronson Reed said, I didn't let him off the phone so easily. You know, he calls people and they're like, oh, okay, and you know, they don't really press him on why. Why are you firing me? He said he kept Johnny on the phone and was pressing him and wanted him to give him a reason why. And Johnny, he didn't have much to say. He kind of mumbled around a little bit and budget cuts, sorry. And that was that. Who knows where he would be right now? Maybe he would be a champion. Maybe he would have been doing jobs for the male models on SmackDown. But he deserved a chance and they completely fucked him over. He deserved a chance to get over on the main roster. How do you know the guy can't hit the ball if you never even put him in the game? But that was Vince McMahon who made the call, not Triple H. Triple H is the one calling the shots now, and Triple H is well aware of what Bronson Reed can do. I do think he'll end up back in WWE one day. I would rather see him stick with New Japan, though, for the time being. Triple H cannot just take everybody back. Otherwise, he's going to end up like Tony Khan. He'll have all these people. He won't know what to do with all of them. Last week, I noted that Triple H was bringing Road Dogg back to the company to replace Jeff Jarrett as the vice president of live events. Road Dogg was part of Triple H's team in NXT before he was released in January. Someone else was released that same day in January, who was also a major part of the team that Triple H put together in NXT, and that was Ryan Katz, who worked there as a creative producer. He wore many different hats for them behind the scenes, but he was very heavily praised for his work with character development and vignettes. He also taught promo classes at the PC when Dusty Rhodes passed away. His time there dates all the way back to 2013. He was actually hired as the first employee of the Performance Center. He was brought in as Dusty's apprentice. And since his release, he has been co-hosting a podcast with Road Dogg, and he confirmed on the most recent episode that he, too, was heading back to WWE. He said he's not even sure what he'll be doing, which sounds very strange to accept the job offer without knowing exactly what the job will entail. It'd be kind of funny if he shows up to work and they put a mop in his hand and says, get cleaning. The floors aren't going to clean themselves. But he is back with WWE in some capacity. He said he was supposed to start back on Thursday, but that date has already been pushed back. So Triple H, slowly but surely reassembling the team that Vince McMahon and his minions tore down, right? Getting the band back together. If Regal and Samoa Joe were free, I'm sure that they would be his right-hand men. Samoa Joe and William Regal would be right at his hip. They would be attached to the hip with Triple H right now. Still might be. we'll see. We'll see how. I don't know how long they have on their deals. I'm sure they're signed for a while, but could eventually happen. The former Velveteen Dream, Patrick Clark, who seemed like he was on the fast track to superstardom before the accusations against him about the grooming stuff, which he denied, he was arrested twice in 1 week. So he seems to be doing well. On August 20th, he was arrested by Orlando police for first-degree battery and trespassing on property after a warning. That arrest later triggered a second arrest this past week for an out-of-county warrant for possession of drug paraphernalia in Florida for a previous incident that took place in November of last year. The Seminole County Sheriff's Office confirmed to PW Insider that Clark violated his probation from that earlier case, which is what led to his latest arrest. According to Mike Johnson, court records note that Clark was arrested in November of 2021 by the Altamonte Springs Police Department and charged with cocaine possession, use or possession of drug paraphernalia, destroying, altering, or concealing physical evidence, and having no lamps or illuminating devices in his vehicle. Those records indicate that on April 21st of this year, he was sentenced to 12 months probation on the possession of drug paraphernalia charge, $213 in court costs, as well as community service as part of a plea agreement. And given that he was only 4 months into that probation when he got arrested this time, obviously that set off some alarm bells. The arresting officer in that drug case testified about it. I'm going to read this to you because, I don't know, I'm just visualizing this. It's sad. It's not really funny, but it kind of is. So this is what the officer said. Sitting inside, I observed a black male later identified as Patrick Clark, who was speaking with PFC Belt. I assume Belt is the name of the other officer. I'm just reading this here. Clark provided his Maryland driver's license and vehicle information to PFC Belt, who then walked back to his patrol vehicle. I remained on the passenger side door, keeping a visual of Clark, to maintain officer safety. While standing outside the passenger door, I observed Clark pull a small clear baggie containing a white powdery substance out of his wallet. Clark proceeded to open the baggie, placing the white powdery substance on the side of his left hand in a line pattern. Based on my training and experience, I recognized the white powdery substance to be cocaine. At that time, Clark began to sniff the powdery substance up his nose. I began to wave PFC Belt over to the vehicle for assistance. I then began to tell Clark to drop the baggie and place his hands in the air. During this time, Clark was attempting to conceal the small clear baggie in between the driver's seat and center console, with white powdery substance spilling on the driver's seat as well as his person. Clark then exited the vehicle and was placed in agency-issued handcuffs for further investigation. So the bag was empty because he shoved half of it up his nose and spilled the other half. And he did this in full view of the cops. So not the brightest bulb in the box is the Velveteen Dream. The bond paperwork in that case noted that Tahuti Miles put up the cash to bail him out of jail. Tahuti Miles is the real name of Ashanti the Adonis of Hit Row. Clark is still being held behind bars in Seminole County, where he was transferred on Wednesday, and he has a court date scheduled for September 19th. There was no chance of WWE bringing him back even before this, and now there is even less than a chance of that happening. What's less than zero? That is how likely you are to see him back in WWE. What a waste. What a waste. Real quick here, NXT Worlds Collide is literally going on the air in a few hours as I am recording this. I just want to run through the card and my predictions real quick. Bron Breakker, the NXT champion, is going to be wrestling the NXT UK champion, Tyler Bate, in a unification match. I got Bron Breakker going over there. There is a women's title unification with Mandy Rose, Mako Satomura, and Blair Davenport. I think Davenport's going to get the win. I think they're going to put those titles on her. That's also a unification. There will be a four-team elimination match to unify the NXT tag titles and NXT UK tag team titles, with the Creed brothers, Brooks and Jensen, Pretty Deadly, and two members of Gallus. And I think that Gallus is going to win those titles. Two other title matches have Katana Chance and Caden Carter defending against Nikki Ash and Doudrop, who showed up on NXT Tuesday to issue the challenge. I think Chance and Carter retain. And then we have the North American Championship on the line. Carmelo Hayes defending against Ricochet. Yes, there he was back in NXT on Tuesday. Rick O'Shea shows up to issue the challenge. That's going to be an insane match. That's the match I'm looking forward to most on this show. I think Carmelo retains. I don't see him losing the title. So that's the card. Again, I'm not going to be doing a formal review just because of the AEW show. I'm not going to have time, but I will watch. And if I have any thoughts, I'm sure I'll have it on the podcast next week. I watched the A&E biography last Sunday on Rey Mysterio and thought it was one of the better ones that they've done. They actually had plenty of photos and video of him throughout the episode of him unmasked. So they didn't shy away from that. They didn't blur it out or anything like that. They were very open with a lot of stuff on here. Conan was a very big part of the episode too, talking about Rey's career and how he helped him get noticed and booked. And Conan has been Rey's biggest advocate from the time the two of them met. And Conan was a huge star at the time in Mexico. They've been best friends ever since. So it was important to get his perspective, and I was glad that they brought him in to be interviewed for this. But yeah, they talked about Rey starting his career at 14 years old as the Green Lizard, working his first match in the parking lot of a church in Tijuana. He didn't mention this in the episode, but he made no money for his first match. Instead, they paid him with a sandwich and a can of Coca-Cola. Later on, he worked as El Colibri, which stands for the Hummingbird. And then in August of 91 is when he was gifted the name Rey Mysterio Jr. by his uncle, Rey Mysterio, who thought that he had earned the right to go by that name. They got into his time, getting into ECW. Paul Heyman, found out about him and connected with Conan and brought in not only Mysterio but Psicosis to ECW as well. That was around the fall of 95. And they became fan favorites. Paul Heyman said, "My God, the way these guys got over, I want to get them booked for, the next date and the next date and the next date." And in this country, that's really how Rey got noticed, as a lot of guys did back then. Jericho, Dean Malenko, Eddie Guerrero. It was first through ECW under Paul Heyman. And then from there, they went to WCW and then WWE. So that's really how they first got over here in the U.S., But then Conan, ended up getting into WCW, and so he was able to get Rey into WCW. And it was June of 1996 when he wrestled at the Great American Bash and opened a lot of eyes on that show. There were a lot of talents who were kind of making fun of him for being too small, and that it's a recurring theme throughout the episode, especially early in his career. He was small. He looked like a child. And it was something that he just had to overcome. When he was initially being booked in Mexico, the promoter wanted to book him as a mini. They did. They booked him to work with the minis. So he had, a lot of obstacles to overcome because of his size. But he went out there, I think it might have been against Dean Malenko, and he had this great match and said that when he got to the back, everybody was giving him a standing ovation. That's how impressed they were by him. They did get into his friendship with Eddie Guerrero. They talked about their match at Halloween Havoc in 1997. They had Eric Bischoff as a talking head in this special. He didn't say anything overly stupid, as he said before. But he talked about wanting Rey to lose his mask. It was a mask versus title match for the Cruiserweight title at the Great American... Halloween Havoc. And Bischoff wanted Rey to lose. He wanted him to lose, and he would lose his mask. And now, of course, in hindsight, Bischoff says, I didn't fully appreciate how much that meant to Rey and the Luchadors and how important the mask was. And they even had old footage of Eddie Guerrero giving an interview, I think in 2004, talking about how I was more than happy to put Rey over that night instead, and Rey obviously was very upset. He didn't want to lose his mask. Now, I did a countdown on the podcast in 2019 of the best Rey Mysterio matches. All the clips are in a playlist on the YouTube channel. If you ever want to go back through them, you can go through them one by one. And I had this match at Halloween Havoc as the number one match in the countdown. This was Rey Mysterio's greatest match. And the story that they did not tell or fully flesh out in the episode, is that about an hour before the match, Eddie Guerrero was still scheduled to go over. Up to an hour before they went out there, Eddie was still scheduled to win the match. There was a lot of drama going on behind the scenes. Ray did not want to lose his mask. Eric Bischoff had no respect for the tradition of the masks and Lucha Libre and what it meant to these guys. And Ray was talking to Conan. And Conan was telling him, don't go to the show. Don't even go to the building. Tell him you're hurt. Ray then gets a call from Eric Bischoff at home because he found out that Ray was talking about no-showing or thinking about no-showing. And Eric made it very clear to him that if you do not show up, you are going to be in breach of contract. And understandably, that freaked out Ray, and he figured, well, I guess I'm going to the show. So he gets there, and he's looking for Eric to talk to him. He's going to try to convince him, you know, please don't take this mask off me. And he can't find Eric Bischoff. And 20 minutes before the match, Arn Anderson comes over, and he says, the finish has changed, you're going over. And so Eddie told Ray, look, we don't have to do the match if you don't want to. He was ready to, you know, again, this is before they found out the finish got changed. Eddie was fully in support of Ray, and he said, look, we don't have to do this if you don't want to. I'm ready to back you up on this 100%. So then Ray finds out that the finish has been changed, and he goes to Eddie, what are we going to do? And, yeah, we got to go out there in 20 minutes. And Eddie just tells him, just shut up and listen to me out there. And he did. And Eddie made him look like $1 million. And then Ray lost the title back to Eddie on Nitro 2 weeks later and didn't have to lose his mask this time. Although he did eventually lose it at the Super Bowl pay-per-view in 99. This time there was no getting out of it. That's when he took the mask off and Kevin Nash is looking at him and going, oh, put the mask back on, put the mask back on. After the WWE bought out WCW in 2001... Bruce Pritchard and Jim Ross were interviewed for this as well, and they were explaining that there were no plans for Rey Mysterio. And JR kind of told him, look, spend time with your family. He may have been on a guaranteed deal where he was going to get paid anyway. He told him, just stay home with your family. And his wife, Angie, is also interviewed for this. And Angie talks about being pregnant at the time with their second child, with their daughter, Aaliyah. And Rey was very worried because he didn't think that Vince McMahon was going to want a small guy like him, and she started to talk about Ray, like, hating her, right? But she her voice kind of trailed off. Like, she didn't really want to talk about this. And off camera, you can hear Ray in the background telling her, just tell the truth. Tell the whole story. Be honest. He goes, I was a dick. And so she collects herself because she was starting to cry. She was getting very emotional. And she collects herself and she's trying to hold back tears, and she says that when she was pregnant with Aaliyah, Ray made her cry a lot and would call her fat and would call her all kinds of names. And Ray admits, he goes, I was a bad husband at the time. I was a bad husband. I was a bad father. I did things that I, you know, don't look back on fondly and I regret doing, and I'm embarrassed and ashamed. And he said the moment that Aaliyah was born, he just kind of snapped out of it, and he apologized, and he, you know, became a different person. And then, of course, in 2002 is when he gets the call that WWE wants to bring him in. And not only bring him in, but they're going to bring him back in under a mask. So he was maskless for a couple of years, and now they want to bring him back and pretend that never happened and put him, you know, back under the mask. They covered the ladder match for custody of Dominic with Ray and Eddie at SummerSlam in 2005. They left out the part in the highlights where Vicky, I guess, was, I don't know if she was late. I think she was late to the ring or whatever. And I just remember Eddie was openly cursing and dropping F-bomb. Where the fuck is Vicky? They let us, the best part of the match, they left that out. But they talked about Eddie's passing. And obviously Ray got very emotional talking about this. He said that he was brought into the hotel room to say goodbye and saw Eddie laying there and, yeah, it was very emotional. And after that, they created this story out of Ray doing it for Eddie, and he wins the Royal Rumble, and he goes on to WrestleMania and becomes the World Heavyweight Champion. They ignored all the tasteless shit that they did leading up to it with, you know, the Eddie's in Hell stuff. They left that out. They also went into Ray's painkiller addiction that he had in 2008, which led to him going to rehab for a month. I don't know if that was public knowledge before this or not. I don't recall any stories about Ray going to rehab, so he was talking openly about that. And then they talked about something that, honestly, I didn't know they were, or I didn't think that they would cover here in this episode, especially because it came outside of WWE after he had left the company and was doing stuff. He did Lucha Underground. He did a bunch of different things, but there was the infamous match in Tijuana in 2015. It was, a six-man tag. And it was Rey Mysterio was on one side of the ring and Perro Aguayo. Perro Aguayo Jr. was on the other side of the ring. And in the middle of the match, Aguayo suffered a broken neck and a heart attack, which led to him, passing away. And I remember watching this footage, because it was all over the place after the match, happened. And you see his body is just limp, and it's hanging on the middle rope. Ray's getting ready to do a 619. And he says in the episode, and they show it, by the way. I was surprised they showed it. I mean, I thought maybe they still images or whatever. They fucking showed the video. And Ray said that when he went for the 619, he barely grazed Aguayo's head, because I think he was supposed to move. And he didn't move because he was fucking dead, right? Or near death. But you watch the footage and he just barely grazed and skinned the top of his head. He goes, had he hit him full force in the face, I mean, that would have been even worse. And obviously that was traumatizing for him. They showed him being carried out and then he dies at the hospital. And Ray is completely traumatized by this. And he went to the funeral and he's facing Perro's family and asking for forgiveness. And they told him, look, we don't blame you. It's not your fault. But that's got to be a tough thing, right? I mean, you're in the ring, you're doing all these spots. This guy suffers a broken neck. How do you not blame yourself? How do you ever get back in the ring after that? It's just, I can't even fathom being in that situation. But he did come back, and they talked about the stem cell therapy. They showed him getting injected in the shoulders and the knees and everything. A lot of wrestlers, more and more wrestlers are doing the stem cell stuff. They're going down to Central America, South America. They have these bio labs down there that are doing these stem cell treatments, and Kevin Nash is one. I mean, they swear by it. It's short term. They have to keep going back for more, but it really is something that has helped Ray just stretch out the length of his career. I thought Ray was done around 2010-ish. He was having injury after injury. His body was breaking down, knee injuries. How can you not? The guy's been wrestling since 1989. He was 14 years old. Look at the style. I'm surprised he made it that long, right? And I'm thinking, okay, this is it. This is the end of Rey Mysterio. That was in 2010. It is 2022 going on 2023, and this guy is still going out there and moving around the way he is. It's incredible. I mean, if I'm one of these stem cell companies, this is my poster child right here. So they got into that as well. And I thought on the whole, again, a very good episode. They cover topics that I didn't think they would cover. Tonight is the final A&E biography. They're covering the first WrestleMania, so it's not a person. They're covering the first Mania. And the final Rivals episode is going to focus on the Stephanie McMahon Brie Bella feud and match from 2014. I'll be skipping that one. I think I'll pass. If you have mailbag questions, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in so I can shout you out. Like Caleb from Kalamazoo. I am sending this before Clash at the Castle, so I am not sure if this theory will be ruined with a Roman win on Saturday, but what is your take on this prediction for Cody at WrestleMania? I think Drew McIntyre needs to win the title at Clash at the Castle. But Cody versus Drew does not seem like a very dramatic match to Main Event Mania to me. That's because it's not. What if around December or Royal Rumble time, Randy Orton returns and beats Drew McIntyre for the WWE Universal title? Then Cody wins the Royal Rumble, which leads to the mentor versus protege story, Randy Orton against Cody Rhodes for the title at WrestleMania 39. What say you? Well, first of all, it was ruined. Roman Reigns did retain his championship. I think that the story works much better. If you're going to do that, I think that if Drew had won the title yesterday, I think it would have worked much better to have Seth Rollins be the one to eventually beat Drew and take the titles, and then have Cody win the Rumble and go to WrestleMania and beat Seth and not beat Randy. Cody Rhodes and Randy Orton are eventually going to work together. But now is not the time to tell that story. Especially if Orton's going to come back, if let's say he does come back, he's still a babyface, maybe they go back to the RK-Bro thing for a little while longer. You know, it's just not the right time. The story to tell them would be Cody and Seth, not Cody and Orton. So, but anyway, yes, you were incorrect. Drew McIntyre, he's a loser. He did not pull it off. But don't worry about him because he's at the bar singing show tunes, so he'll be okay. Chris from Phoenix, one thing that I have been thinking about a lot lately is the amount of TV time that wrestling shows produce. WWE gets slammed for 3 hours of Raw as being too long, while AEW gets ridiculed for not getting everybody on TV every week in their 2 hours of Dynamite. If you were to wave a magic wand to give each promotion the right amount of TV time each week, how would that look to you? Aside from not giving the Jericho storylines 2+ segments every week, how would you get more of the roster involved on Dynamite? I am a big advocate for less is more. I don't want more television time. I want less television time. I still feel the ideal length for a show is 90 minutes. It's that halfway point between 1 and 2 hours, 2 hours max. No more than that, but even I think 90 minutes would be the perfect length. What I would do, though, is I would basically split Dynamite into two shows. Now, it's called Rampage, but I would make it more like a second Dynamite, not a throwaway show. Ideally, you would be able to do it live every week. That way, you get 2 hours on one night and 2 hours on the other. That would give them a better chance of kind of spreading the wealth and getting more people on the show. You're not going to get them on the show every week. They don't have to be on the show every week. But I think 2 hours for Dynamite, 2 hours for Rampage, if Rampage were actually booked like a Dynamite, I think would be fine. WWE, they have 3 hours of Raw. That's what USA wanted. They gave it to them. If they ever leave USA, I hope to God they go back to 2 hours. Because that show does not need to be 3 hours. SmackDown does not ever have to go to 3 hours. The only 3-hour wrestling show I care to see is a pay-per-view. And even the pay-per-views are too long. Maybe I'm just getting very impatient as I get older. I don't know. Call me crazy, but we have 15 matches on the AEW card tonight, which I'm sure it's going to be a kick-ass show when it's over. Oh my God, what an amazing show. I'm sure it'll be fine. 15 matches is too many fucking matches. This show is going to be with the pre-show 5 hours tonight. That is too much. It's too much. You may not think it's too much. I'm telling you it's too much. You don't have to squeeze everybody onto the show. Andrew from Birmingham, England. Big fan, been for over 10 years. If you remember, I took a Solomonster sign to a What Culture wrestling show a few years back. I do remember that. I don't remember what the sign said, though. Was it just Solomonster sounds off? How far do you think Penta El Zero could go in AEW? He is one of my favorite wrestlers, and I'm wondering if you think he could go as far as AEW World Champion. Are there any other current mid-carders that you think are possibly underused who could be used in a title push? I don't see Penta becoming an AEW World Champion. So I don't see that happening. I do think you could give him a singles push. But no, I don't see him being a world champion. I think the language barrier also works against him in that spot. As far as the other talents who could be used in a title push, Wardlow, I mean, obviously, Wardlow should be that guy at some point. And again, I throw Ricky Starks out there. You know, I put his name out there too. Ricky Starks, he may not be physically the biggest guy that they have, but he can work, he can talk, he's got charisma, he checks those boxes of what you would look for in a star. Ray in Portland, I watched a shoot interview from 2000 with the late Playboy Buddy Rose. In it, a caption comes on screen saying that Buddy used the DDT in the WWF before Jake the Snake Roberts. Is that true? And if so, who actually innovated the move? Yes, Buddy Rose called it, I couldn't remember what he called it. He called it the Vegas Jackpot, I think, or the Las Vegas Jackpot. I believe Adrian Adonis may have also used it in WWF before Jake came in. They called it a reverse bulldog. I'm sure Jake didn't create the move. I know he tells the story of inventing it by accident when he went for a suplex in a match, but he fell backwards, and the move got a reaction, so he figured, hey, we'll go with this from now on. I'm sure Jake had never seen it before, so in his mind, he invented it. And I mean, he definitely popularized it and perfected it. But it's hard for me to believe that it wasn't already being used somewhere else. You know, again, there's two people right there in WWF who were using it before he did. Marcellus from Maryland. I remember when Edge returned in 2010 from injury, he was a babyface, but it only lasted a few months. Do you know why his face run was not long? I remember he lost to Chris Jericho at WrestleMania that year. Yeah, he won the Royal Rumble, but then he lost at WrestleMania. And it wasn't long after that, I think, that they had the draft. And he went to Monday Night Raw. So I think it was mostly just a case of him switching brands and having more people to work with as a heel. Since Raw already had John Cena, they had Triple H. Because this would have been 2010. Yeah, I mean, they had Cena, they had Triple H on top as babyfaces. And I think Randy Orton also, he ended up as a babyface coming out of WrestleMania that year. Edge, I mean, let's be honest, Edge is just better as a heel anyway. So I think it was a combination of those two things. More babyfaces to work with, and he's better off as a heel. David from Sacramento, if the concept of Money in the Bank was around prior to the Ruthless Aggression era, who are the names that would have benefited the most with the briefcase from the Golden, New Generation, and Attitude eras? Well, let me just say this. I am glad Money in the Bank was not around back then. But if it was, for the Golden era, I would go with Mr. Perfect. For the New Generation era, I think it would have fit a heel Shawn Michaels perfectly. And Attitude era, probably... You know, I could see either Kurt Angle or Shane McMahon taking it and having them out there on TV every week teasing a cash-in. I think heel Kurt, not long after he came in, when he was still doing the comedy... Kurt Angle or Shane McMahon. Christoph from Belgium. I've been rewatching WWF 1999, and I cannot help but feel like something more was planned when Vince briefly turned babyface to oppose Shane's corporation. For starters, if it was all a swerve, then Vince sure got his ass beat by Shane in the corporate ministry a lot. Also, during the abduction of Stephanie, Vince had quite a few opportunities to screw Steve Austin over, yet he helped him out a few times. Also noteworthy is that Vince surprisingly got over huge with the crowd as a babyface. Yet he revealed himself as the higher power, which subsequently wasted months of storyline progression, as well as the Union faction. I don't buy it that this was the plan all along. What are your thoughts? I don't find it hard to believe at all that Vince McMahon would have killed the Union. You gotta kill it before it grows. That doesn't surprise me at all. Now, look, this is just what they did. I mean, they were very hyperactive when it came to the storylines back during that era. There were swerves and changes from babyface to heel, heel to babyface all the time. And a lot of times they didn't make a whole lot of sense. If you tried to apply logic to each one of them, you would have been able to find plenty of logic holes. I think that he took one on the chin and took all the abuse that he did to make it more shocking when he ultimately screwed Steve Austin at Over the Edge. Yeah, you know, when he lost to the Undertaker. So, how far back the plan went? Did they know 6 months before? No, they didn't know 6 months before. But I don't think they came up with it on the spot either. I think they probably had that plan in mind maybe for a couple of months. But again, this was back in the Russo period. There were really no such thing as long-term planning during that period. You know, long-term today means something very different than long-term would have meant back in 1998. 1999. I mean, how many long-term stories did they really have during that period that you could look back on and say, oh, I'm kind of connecting the dots. It started here and they had a plan for how it would end a year later, right? Or a year and a half later. You don't see that. They were booking, and Russo has said this, he was booking for ratings. He was booking based on ratings patterns. And so if someone was drawing ratings and now they weren't, then they probably would drop that person and start pushing somebody else. He was booking based on the whims of the numbers at a time when the numbers meant, you know, even more than they do today. We've got Alan from North Hollywood, California. Did you know that late R&B singer Luther Vandross was a wrestling fan? There was a biography on him around the late 90s or early 2000s, and it mentioned that in between rehearsals, he would watch SmackDown. They should have brought him in to sing the national anthem at a pay-per-view. I was aware, I think I may have answered a question years ago about this. They actually did a feature on him. If anybody is a collector of the old WWF magazines, and I don't have this issue, but I started collecting the magazine in 92. So the very first issue of the WWF magazine as part of a subscription that I ever had, and I still have it. In fact, I had it signed many years ago by Ric Flair, was the issue where Flair is sitting in the director's chair. He's on the cover of the magazine. That was my first one. But if you go back, it was sometime around 85 or 86. And I think it was WWF Magazine at that point. They changed the name. It used to be Victory Magazine, but I think by then it may have just been WWF Magazine. They did a feature on Luther Vandross in that issue. They interviewed him. So yeah, he was a huge wrestling fan. He used to go to a lot of the Madison Square Garden shows back in the 90s. And we'll end with Sebastian from Lima, Peru. Hello, Solomon, sir. I wanted to ask two questions, one for wrestling and one for curiosity. Now that Triple H is in charge, do you think there is a chance of seeing War Games on the main roster? And if so, who would you like to see in that first War Games match? I do think there's a chance. We know Triple H is a big War Games fan. He brought it back to NXT. You know, Raw versus SmackDown, the Bloodline, you got Roman Reigns, the Usos, Solo Sikoa, you know, maybe even Sami Zayn with them. And then on the opposing side, Kevin Owens, Bobby Lashley, AJ Styles, maybe Matt Riddle, maybe even Randy Orton. Maybe RK-Bro is back together if they can get Randy back by then. And that way you can sort of further the Owens and Zayn story. They would really have to want to drag it out, though. I mean, we're talking about late November. I don't know how long they want to wait before they do Owens and Zayn against the Usos. I mean, shit, if they're going to hold off on Roman until WrestleMania dropping the belts, the Usos may go to WrestleMania. We may not have new tag team champions until April of next year. It's like, how are you going to fill all of this time between now and then? That's the challenge that lies before Triple H. How are you going to fill that time and make it interesting and not kill your entire roster by having the Bloodline just kill everybody off? His second question, though, is if I had the money to travel to 5 places in South America, which places would I choose? Well, I have been to Colombia before. I even left a little piece of myself there. I have been to Costa Rica, although I guess that would be Central America. I don't know about 5, but I would love to visit Brazil one day. And Peru. I mean, you had to know I was going to say Peru. You got a place for me? Anyway, email me thesolomonster@gmail.com if you have any questions, suggestions, or anything else you'd like to send in. You never know when you may hear it here on the show. We are in the middle of a very busy weekend. I want to thank everybody who has been sticking with me for all the streams and supporting the flagship here, the main audio show as well. A lot of news to cover, a lot of stuff going on. It's not over yet. We've got Worlds Collide. We've got AEW All Out. And when that event is over, I will be live on YouTube to recap the entire thing. So I do hope that you will subscribe to the channel if you are not already. I'll get the live chat up. Probably, I don't know, a couple of hours maybe before the show. You can hang out there if you want. And hit that like button. And I'll be back next Sunday, episode 773 of the Solomonster Sounds Off as we approach our 15-year anniversary in November. That is when I recorded the very first Sound Off. It was on a Tuesday. I remember that because the first thing I talked about was Raw from the night before, and there was a segment where Steve Austin was a guest. He was there to promote some direct-to-DVD movie that he had done, and he did a segment with Santino Marella. They were recreating the beer truck thing. He was hosing him down, and I remember it like it was yesterday. So anyway, we are fast approaching the 15-year anniversary. Be well, stay safe, enjoy your Labor Day if you've got yourself a day off, which I hope you do. And I will see you back here next Sunday for 773. Take care, guys.
The Salamonsters sounds off.
We had Butch taking on Ludwig Kaiser. So Butch targeted the fingers of Kaiser. Kaiser rolled to the floor. Kaiser rolled. Oh, I just popped myself. Kaiser roll. I fucking love it. I'm going to take a drink of that. Sometimes it's the little things that amuse me the most. Oh, man. Kaiser roll to the floor. I promise you, Sean, I was not. I didn't have that in my back pocket. I was not waiting for the rim shot. Sometimes these things just come together in a perfect way.
The Salamonster sounds off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Salamonster on Twitter at Salamonster.
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 Salamonster sounds off.